All right, good morning.
Good morning.
Is that a little hot? Good morning. It's a little more gentle, maybe. Maybe I was just too amped up. I missed you last week, so I have to, bring it today, I guess. Well, it is good to be back together, back with you. Let me invite you to go ahead and turn to your neighbor this morning and say, I am glad you're here. Otherwise, I would be talking to myself. That might apply to me more than anybody else. I'm glad you're here. Otherwise, well, I guess we're always talking to God, right? So we're never alone. I guess I thought that was a fun one, and I couldn't resist the temptation. So let me go ahead and dismiss. We do have some younger ones. Let me go ahead and dismiss to Children's Church, Junior Church. If you can send one of those tiny chairs, church. I want to thank Aaron. Aaron's not here today, but thank him for last week. I did listen online, listened as I was putting it online, and really appreciated what he shared. Forgiveness is one of those things that I think is really central to life and how we do life and relationships together, which is exactly what we are looking at in a broader sense, right? These are the most significant teachings of Jesus, right? Collected here in what is called the Sermon on the Mount. What is this invitation to this whole other way of doing life, doing relationships? It's a way of life that really flows from the very heart of God, and as we've seen most recently, flows then into this way of prayer, right? It finds expression in the activity of prayer, in the practice of prayer. Jesus begins here, Matthew 6 and 9, right? This then is how you should pray. Right, again, this is a prayer not of belief, but it's a prayer of action. This then is how you should pray. The you here being plural, this is how you all should pray. Again, this is not me and my, this is us and ours. What is that communal ethic we've talked about over the recent weeks? An ethic that now flows to the very last line of this prayer. Matthew 6 and 13, Jesus says, we read, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Now you might remember, this was some time ago, back in the late 60s, early 70s, 1960s, 1970s, so quite some time ago now, that psychologist Walter Mischel, led an experiment. In essence, this study about self-control in the face of temptation. It later became known as the marshmallow test. And so Mischel would invite children, and he would take a child into a room, and the child would sit at a table, and there would be this small plate with a marshmallow on it. And by way of the study, a researcher would be in the room with the child, and the researcher would say something in essence, maybe to Angela, age 5, would say, I'm going to leave the room for a few moments, and while I'm gone, you may eat the marshmallow if you want, or if you wait until I get back, I will give you a second marshmallow. And then the researcher would leave the room, and the camera would roll. And as you can imagine, it became quite a comical sight. You can look online. I think there's a few clips of these children. Many of them it was like a stare down with the marshmallow. They were going to resist the temptation to take this because they knew maybe another one was coming along. Others would spin in their chair, hide under the desk. They would cover their eyes. Some decided, forget it, and would simply eat it and be done with it. In the end, and based on what was hundreds of hours of research and observation, Mischel explained, he said the real measure was not willpower, but rather what he called the strategic allocation of attention. The strategic allocation of attention. noting the kids, those kids who were most successful at, we could say, resisting the temptation, were the ones who were able to shift their focus onto to something else, towards something else. They were able to shift their attention, shift their focus toward something else. Right? It's the idea that if we fixate on something, it begins to own us. Right? If we fixate on something, and this was something that clearly Adam and Eve knew back in Parsha Bereshit from Genesis 3. Right? Adam and Eve, they're in this garden filled with just this incredible abundance. That is, until the serpent draws their attention to the one tree. And when that happens, what was once peripheral becomes central, and focus becomes fixation. And that thing, whatever that thing is for you, that thing now begins to own you. In the words of James chapter 1, but each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire, right? Their focus becomes fixation. Then after that fixation now has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. And every one of us has that stuff. Okay, no one gets a free pass on this one. The Apostle Paul makes it clear, 1 Corinthians 10 and 13, no temptation has seized you except what is common to all. Right? We all live in this space. And yet, we read, God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will always provide a way out so that you can endure it. He will always give you that opportunity, right, to be successful. And to be successful, we shift our focus toward the something else. We'll get more into that in a moment, right? So no one here is exempt, right? We all have our own sort of marshmallow of sorts, right? I've shared this before. When I was a little boy and I saw that harmonica in that Christian supply store, no less. And for me, what was on the periphery now became central, and my focus became fixation. I didn't even know what shoplifting meant, right? But there I was. More recently, and a challenge that's been probably been most of my life, all of my life, is that tendency to be less than honest. Growing up, my childhood being abused, you learn that truth is not safe. And so being less than honest, or to put it more bluntly, lying becomes a way of survival. And so as I got older, realizing that there's this temptation for me to be less than honest, to lie, even in the most simplest of things, even in the things that really don't matter. But there's this temptation for me to be less than honest, and kind of reworking that. You know, it's not just an urge, but it was the giving into it. Now I don't know about you. Maybe you can relate, right? Times when temptation has maybe gotten a hold of you, right? And the thing is, it doesn't end, right? Temptation continues to present itself to us, right? And it's like you want to say stop, you try to say stop, you try to say to stop it. You self control and more willpower and a new resolution, and we think this day it will be different, but it doesn't work, right? Temptation does not play fair. From Peter, he says, for your enemy, the devil, and we can think you're the tempter, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. And so it's in that moment when you're hurting, that moment when you're overwhelmed, or maybe it's feeling lonely, Maybe when, you know, the financial pressure is beginning to crush you, or the medical news begins to shake you, family tensions won't release, and then here comes temptation, right? Prowling. Right, here comes temptation and conception and birth. And I don't know, maybe, you know, it's the drink, it's the pill, it's the hit, it's the drag, it's the pull. Maybe it's the look across the room, right? When things are feeling unsettled, and pretty soon that look becomes an open door. Maybe it's a harsh word, right? Spoken, and in that moment you have that release of tension, the release of that frustration, and yet the hurt that is caused leads to a closed door. Maybe it's the extra comfort of food, or maybe it's buying things that we can't afford. Whatever it is, we all face temptation. And the "I'm going to stop doing that, and I'm going to use more self-control or find more willpower," it doesn't work. New resolutions don't work. Paul himself faced this reality, and I think he was very honest about his battle. Romans 7, "For what I am doing, I do not understand, for I am not practicing what I want to do, but I am doing the very thing I hate." And then dropping down to verse 19, "For what I do is not the good I want to do, no, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing." And it's into that reality. It's into that reality that here comes Jesus offering us this prayer. Again, not a prayer of belief, but a prayer of action, right? "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." Now, to get at that just for a few minutes, I want us to note, for one, this is not, as it seems to suggest, this is not God enticing us toward sin. The word here translated temptation comes from the Greek, peirasmos, which in the ancient world, it probably would have been translated more like test. It would be a test, not a test to fail you, not a test to break you, but a test to make you stronger, to build you up, to make you better, right? So it is temptation. Temptation works here as a translation, but it's in this idea that it's for your good. In the same way, we can think of metal that is tested, right? Metal that is tempted beyond its normal sort of stress, right? So that it might show its strength. We have a trampoline in our backyard, and on that label it says that it can hold up to 250 pounds. And we know that, right? Because we know that it's been tested, it's been tempted far beyond that sort of weight. And the point being here is that this final petition, it's for your good, right? It's not for our harm, it's for our good. Temptation, this from the scholar William Barclay, is not so much the penalty of being human, it is the glory of being human. And I think it puts a little bit of a different spin on this idea of temptation, right? This idea that it's temptation, but God's not saying that, you know, I'm going to break you, I'm going to fail you, right? But that I'm going to build you up better, faster, stronger. The next line, I think, supports this, "but deliver us," I think, really kind of drives this home, ruomai in the Greek, noting it carries that idea of to rescue or to deliver. It's a freedom. It's a freedom here, it says, from the evil one, poneiros, related to ponos. Ponos meaning pain or affliction. It's this idea of harm. And so we can think here of harm, and we can think of the one who is doing the harm. In Hebrew, it's Satan. It's where we get our word Satan. But note that in the Hebrew, Satan is never a proper name. That was a later derivative, I guess you could say, or an outcome of Christianity much later. But Satan is simply an adversary, right? Spiritually or human, right? An adversary, one who wants to cause you pain or affliction, one who wants to cause you harm. From 1 Samuel 29, verse 4, it's the Philistines who are afraid that, in fact, David may be their Satan. Kings 5 and 4, Solomon claims that God has given him some rest, right? He's tired and gives him rest on every side, such that there is no Satan left to oppose him. Right? And so this carries that idea, and we could translate this something like, but free us, rescue us from pain, from affliction. Free us, rescue us, deliver us from every harm and from the hand of the one who wants to do us harm. Now with that, we can add to that, and then we're going to land the plane here and just have some time to sit in stillness together. For one, this final petition reads in the sense of what is that ancient sort of Hebrew literary device known as parallelism, right? And so in that sense, and lead us not into temptation, parallels, but deliver us from the evil one, which in Greek is tautology. Tautology, tato, it means same, logos means word. And so whether it's Greek or Hebrew, really here it's two ways of saying the same thing. Right, and so again, and lead us not into temptation is parallel, is the same as, but deliver us from the evil one. Second here, Jesus here is speaking in what grammarians call laetites. It's this ironic understatement that in which an affirmative is expressed by the contrary. And so, by way of example, if you listen to somebody and they're singing and you think, wow, that's a beautiful voice, you know, and then you lean to your friend and you say, that is not a bad singer, okay? Or somebody who you think has great wisdom, right? You would say he's no fool, right? And so it's the reverse. And so I should say that to say this, but that lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. If we were to flip that back to an affirmative, it would read something like this, and guide us in paths of righteousness. And guide us in paths of righteousness, which has everything to do with the strategic allocation of attention. Right? Everything to do with we could say, the reorienting of our focus. Moving us really from trying harder and more willpower to a reorienting ourselves to the God, to our God, right, who guides us in paths of righteousness. And here's where I want to land this today. And this is what I want us to get. In that sense, then, we come full circle. We come full circle. Noting this prayer doesn't really end. But it's at this point that it begins again. Are we together? It's at this point, it's like that song, this is the song that never ends, it goes on and on, my friend. Well, this is the prayer that truly never ends. Because as soon as we get to guide us in paths of righteousness, in that sense it comes full circle. It doesn't end, but it begins again, and it returns us back to our Father in heaven. And if you remember when we were there months ago now, right, that's where we always begin. Right? Whatever it is that's going on in your life, whatever it is that you are facing, whatever temptation is right in front of you, Jesus says, go back to the beginning. Right? Our Father, your name, your kingdom, your will. And I think God knows that we need that. And I think maybe we do too, because what happens when we keep our focus on the temptation, right? And like it was in the experiment and like it is in the garden, whatever that thing is for you, the peripheral becomes central and the focus becomes fixation, and that thing, whatever that thing is, it begins to own you. And as we all know, there is more at stake than simply whether we eat a marshmallow or two. Right? Because in every temptation, there's that reality, right? I'm stressed, I'm overwhelmed, I'm lonely, I'm tired, I'm hungry, I'm worried, I'm confused, and here comes temptation, right? As sly as it is, be it from within or without, right? And like Paul, right? More than I care to admit, what I want to do, I don't, and what I don't want to do, I keep doing. But again, I think God gets it, and God gets us, right? And so when we pray this final petition, it isn't about how strong we are. It isn't about more willpower. It isn't about resolutions. It's about where do we fix our eyes? Where do we fix our eyes? It's about what or who holds our attention. Which I think is why here at the end of the prayer, Jesus calls us again, to begin again, right? To return our focus, right? That strategic allocation of attention. Right? And we're back at the beginning. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth, right? In me, in you, in us, as it is in heaven. And so with that, I do want to, before we get out of here, I want to invite us to sit with this for a little bit. The microphone is somewhere. Available, not available. It's on the stand. All right, I'll make it available. But maybe we can consider, reflect, ask, ponder, where am I most vulnerable to temptation right now? Where am I most vulnerable to temptation? In other words, what is my marshmallow? What is that thing that is peripheral, but it's moving to the center? Where do I notice my focus is maybe becoming fixated? Right, drawing my attention, narrowing my focus. And with that, then we could ask, when temptation comes, where does my attention go? Where does my attention go? Right, we could say, do I fixate on that thing? Or do I take the invitation of Jesus and fix my gaze on God, on our Father in heaven? Maybe we can think about, how can I practice the strategic allocation of attention in my daily life? What would that look like for me? We could ask it this way: how can I reorient my attention toward God? I mean, one of the simple things for me is just having things in a certain way at home and in my truck that allows me to reach for that thing, because I need it when I need it, right? And so maybe it's some of the art that I have on the wall that draws me to turn my gaze to God. Maybe it's the music that I choose to listen to. Maybe it's what I have on my nightstand. But how can I practice? How can I reorient my attention? What practices might help me shift my gaze more toward God? Maybe it's restructuring. Maybe it's getting up a little bit earlier and reading a passage of scripture, reading a devotional, praying with a loved one. Right? Let's think about our schedules, our daily sorts of routines. And maybe, what can I adjust? What would it look like to live today with our Father in heaven, right? Your name, your kingdom, your will at the center of everything I do. Well, let's spend a few moments in silence, and then Roger, when you feel led, you can come back up. Right, this then, Jesus says, is how you should pray. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one.